I'd like to welcome everyone to another episode of Two Men in a Bible Fighting the Cosmic Battle. Sitting right next to me is Pastor Bob Brandon. My name's Jamie Sanchez. And we're here to carry this forward another step.
Another step. And, you know, one of the ways we often think about the podcast, I know I do, and I'm pretty certain you do as well, is the world crowds in around you during the week. And, you know, I have a kind of job that's got many blessings involved in it. You know, I get to do the podcast and mm-hmm. Sunday morning and some Bible studies and so on. But during these times, the world is pushed back from us. And we're just in our own little space, you know, in God's lap, reading his book with him. And it's just so valuable for us. Not just to even send out his word in this form, but just to be with him like that and push the world back is just so valuable.
Well, and as we've been going through the last chapters in Leviticus, it's really kind of really come into my perception or perspective. I don't know what the right word is there, but that right now we're really kind of getting the family coat of arms, you know, what it means, who dad is, you know.
Yeah.
What he expects and you know, what his family is going to be. And it's pretty humbling.
Well, perspective is a good word for that. And your outcome, your takeaway from that is also perfect. It's very humbling. The way we often will summarize that whole process is we're beginning to see the world through his eyes.
Right.
And when that begins to happen, you're transforming. Your own heart is being transformed, and you're transforming the space around you. You've got your own little Eden, you know, Plan A going on.
Well,
the kingdom
really,
of God is ruling in your heart, and it's expanding its territory.
And you feel that.
Yeah.
I know.
And when
for
it's
myself,
not there, you get hungry for that right away.
Oh, it feels very dark and void.
Mm-hmm.
Formless, pointless, meaningless. But we're not at Ecclesiastes, so we won't go there. But
all right, so where are we? Where are we in the text now?
We're at Leviticus 11, Bob, and I tell you, I kind of got the meaning, not got the meaning, but I saw it. It was written, you know,
okay.
But I don't really... It's still, I can't make the connection. I'm not that good a reader yet.
Okay, and so when we discussed this podcast earlier today, I said, you know, we're going to have to set this up for a while. And we'll see how long that takes, but we have to put some things out on the table before we read this. Leviticus 11 begins a section that pretty much goes chapter 11 through chapter 16. The high point, you know, chapter 16 of the... ritual of the scapegoat is going to be really important for the theme of our podcast, for the cosmic battle.
Okay.
And these chapters, 11 through 15, are leading up to that. And this will be very interesting. So we got to paint the context here. We got to put it in the background. Got to put some stuff on a table, okay?
So back to the Bob Ross analogy.
That's right. So listen up. It's helpful to observe at the outset that the laws in this book, Leviticus, are framed by narrative. In other words, this section that we'll begin reading tonight is in the context of a story. So, the significance of this reminds us that the laws were given to a specific people for a specific purpose. So if we can paint in around the edges enough to clarify what's the purpose of these particular laws about clean and unclean and so on, we'll be a long, long way towards understanding what was going on with them, and also so then how to apply this to our own lives. So accordingly, the laws like dietary regulations are not universal, they're not eternal. The principal design of the laws like these enabled the Israelites to exist as a distinct people in the land of Canaan. The underlying motive was doubtless to prevent them from being influenced by the beliefs of the neighboring nations and to preserve them from the degrading defilements and vices of the Canaanites. The distinction in foods was of the greatest value in obtaining this objective. Close personal friendships are easily formed over a shared meal, but it's far more difficult to develop a relationship with people with whom one can neither eat nor drink. And if these people have an abhorrence of the food that one eats, then there's an even greater obstacle to a close relationship. The truth of this observation is obvious to anyone who's traveled to wherever people find it difficult to associate freely with someone of a different ethnic or religious group, largely because of such customs. If any of the foods connected with religious ritual, the issue becomes even greater. Regulations about food and drink are proven effective in keeping groups distinct from each other. Let me pause for a second. Have you seen this in the Bible before, even before Leviticus?
Where God is putting his people, really separating them, creating that?
No, the actual food part of it. Do you remember the Joseph story?
Uh-huh.
His brothers come down and Joseph makes a meal for them, and they're in separate rooms because the Egyptians won't eat with the Hebrews. See, that stuff was pretty common in the ancient Near East. Also, remember in the book of Daniel, we haven't gotten there, but of course in our own reading we have been. And Daniel, when he gets to Babylon, will not eat what Nebuchadnezzar's putting on the table, right? That food's coming from Nebuchadnezzar, saying Daniel's going, don't give us only vegetables, we're not eating that stuff. It keeps them distinct.
Right.
Even in the midst of
the world.
Right, yeah, in the midst of the world. And in the midst of being right there with them, they're still distinct, and everybody notices that.
Well, and at this time, the world would be as chaotic to this group of people as it is to us right now, right?
Yeah, that's right.
You know, Babylon, or would Babylon be there at this time?
Yeah, they exist, but not as the Babylon that we know of in the book of Daniel. But they're there. Remember, Abraham is from Ur, mm-hmm. of the he's Babylonian, basically. So that culture's there. It doesn't exist in the form of the Babylon that we read about in the book of Daniel, for instance, is like Neo-Babylon. That's the revival of that empire. Okay. But those peoples had been there for centuries. They predate the Egyptian civilization. They're the oldest civilization we think on Earth, the Babylonians.
Wow.
So yeah, they were there. So whatever relation one has with someone from another culture, at mealtime, each follows his or her own practices, which form a perpetual reminder of the differences. And in such reminders is the conviction that the others are different, perhaps even unacceptable, because they take detestable or forbidden foods and drinks. Many groups have preserved their religious identity in this way. And so in Leviticus 11, one discovers that the Israelites, by following the law's dietary injunctions, were precluded from assimilation with their pagan neighbors. God's trying to keep them distinct.
Yeah, because without that distinction, it'd be very easy to just lose.
Blend in with
right.
them, which happened anyway. But this was a big barrier to that.
Well, and I know we've had conversations before, Bob, where we've talked about that in today's terms, you know, as far as being a Christian, you know, how that really does distinguish you from others, you know, pretty quickly, you know,
yeah.
it's almost immediate, you know.
Yeah.
Same exact concept, same thing you're talking about.
That's right. Biblical scholars have for some time recognized that these dietary laws had other purposes. besides separating Israel from its pagan neighbors. The institutions in Leviticus 10 that we did last podcast provide the clue that the laws were designed to teach the people how to make distinctions between clean and unclean, between holy and unholy. Since the main point in Leviticus is the holiness, the division between clean and unclean foods corresponds to the division between holy Israel and the Gentile world, respectively. But here's like some of the theories people have had about these laws that we're going to read about. One, maybe it's hygienic, like an unclean animal would make you sick if you ate it. I don't really think that's what's going on in the text, but many have proposed that. Some see it more in a cultic sense, not black magic cult, but as far as worship goes, like unclean animals were associated with non-Israelite deities. And there may be something to that. I think there's probably more to that than people realize, but we'll talk about that in a little bit. Some see these laws as just arbitrary. The dietary laws taught holiness and obedience to Israel, but just because they were laws.
Right.
Just, you know, there's a value in following the law itself. There's no greater purpose. And I don't think that's the best way to go. Many people see them as symbolic. Each unclean animal symbolized more important spiritual things, revealing how the Israelites had to live. And I think there's definitely something to that. None of these are comprehensive, but I think there's something to that one. Again, we'll talk about some of this more in the future. There was a great scholar in this area, not a biblical scholar, sociologist, whose name was Mary Douglas. I want to read a little bit about her because it'll help us. More recently, the emphasis by Mary Douglas on purity and wholeness,
okay,
has prompted many students of the Bible to look again at this topic. The idea is that everything has to correspond to its order. When it does, when it does this, it's pure, healthy, and whole, not impure, blemished, or mixed. What is holy must correspond to the holiness of God and follow the distinctions and divisions that He made. The structure for the order was based on Genesis 1, where the animals were divided among those that fly across the sky, those that walk on the land, those that swim in the water. Each sphere has a particular set of motions and characteristics. So creatures that correspond to their type are clean, and those that don't are unclean. You know, they break the divisions, they break the boundaries. And so like an amphibian, you know, what is that, a land animal or a water animal? Oh, it's got both. Okay, you're unclean then.
Gotcha.
He wants it clearly divided, right? So, for example, a fish without fins and scales is unclean.
Lobster, crab.
Eel. Right? Thus, cleanliness of animals was symbolic and of the pristine order that God wanted, or more exactly, that God had created. So remember I was saying there's a symbolic view of this. That probably has a fair amount of weight to it. Although the working out of this theory has a number of problems. There's some of them you're looking at and you go, that doesn't really fit what we're saying. You know, some of them are exceptions. And there's certain errors with it. It offered an interpretation that was comprehensive for the material and fit the purpose of the chapter in this context. The dietary laws, in the final analysis, are related to Israel's calling and purpose as a holy nation. And holiness demands that people conform to the class to which they belong. So let me read that again, because I think we're at the heart of the matter now. The dietary laws, in the final analysis, are related to Israel's calling and purpose as a holy nation. And holiness demands that people conform to the class to which they belong.
Before you go on, put that in your words. What, you know, be Bob Ross with the painting. Paint that that picture for me. What she's talking about there?
Well, that's not her. That's not Mary Douglas.
Oh,
there.
Okay.
That this is Alan Ross. So anyway, okay. Let me put that in my words. Israel's to be distinct among
back
the nations.
To what you were talking about.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the food laws will keep them distinct. Go a long way towards that. It distinguishes them from all the Gentiles.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's what he's talking about there. The other half of it, that not just to be distinct from somebody else, like in a negative sense, like in other words, the Jew is not to be the Gentile. That's what the food laws are creating, that equation. But there's more to it than that. The Jews are not just not to be Gentiles. They're also to be positively Jewish in the sense that they conform as closely as possible to God's created order. Like, remember, well, we haven't done it on the podcast, I guess, because it's such a visual thing. We have to wait till we get our website to put this up, but the authority structure of the universe.
Yeah, we've described it a couple
Okay,
of
we've
times.
Described it at least. So the problem there was the blending of two of those categories, right?
Right.
Level 2 and level 3 got together
right.
and tried to take over level 1. So the blending of those categories, that's not good.
And again, the authority structure is God, man, angels, creation.
That's right. And keep those distinct.
Right.
So the food laws are doing both. They're saying don't be like that, but they're also saying positively be like this.
Because
that's
something that we read a lot, a couple of words that I see coming up over and over again, unclean
and clean.
Yeah, and holy.
That's right. That's right. We'll talk about that. So let me draw this for you, and then you explain to the listeners what you're looking at.
Okay.
That'll help. So imagine it's like this.
You're just going to draw right in your book?
Yep. I bought it. I can do that. So there's holy and unholy.
Okay.
And of the unholy category, there's clean and unclean.
Okay.
That's the picture they're dealing with.
Because so, on the holy side, you couldn't have clean and unclean. It's just pure.
That's pure and holy. That's right.
Right.
And then there's, it's dedicated for special use. So, for instance, a gold plate, is that holy or unholy? Well, it depends. If you sanctify it with blood and put it in the temple, that now becomes holy. That separated, its use has become distinct now. This is going to be used in God's tabernacle. So that thing became holy. The fact that before it was holy, it wasn't unclean. You know what I mean? There was nothing wrong with the plate. It just wasn't sanctified for God's use.
And is it important to kind of understand the difference between separation and distinction? Because it's not that he's separating them from the world. He's just distinguishing.
Well, I see what you're saying. Yes, that's a great way to say it. The image in my mind is often, you know, imagine a little garden plot, and you've got 11 rows of corn
mm-hmm.
in this little garden plot, and right in the middle, you have the 12th row is tomatoes. Okay, that row of tomatoes is in the garden.
Right.
The rest of the garden is corn. That one's tomatoes. It's distinct in the midst of the corn. So
right.
Would you say, you know, if you were eyeballing that, would you say it was separate or distinct? You'd probably say distinct.
Yeah.
Because separate,
yeah.
No, it's in the same garden with the other.
Right.
There is an idea that it's separate there, but the dominant idea would be it's distinct. So
yeah.
To be distinct in the midst of.
Because when we think separate in, you know, in the Bible, you're thinking, you know, or for me, I immediately go back to Genesis, and I think of that separation that was created right there.
Yeah, between God and man. Yeah, the
but
death,
that's not what we're talking about.
The essence of death, separation's the essence. No, we're talking about distinction. That's right.
Yeah.
A pure distinction.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay.
So there's things that are holy, there are things that are unholy. Of the things that are unholy, there's two categories within that, clean and unclean. And it doesn't mean, like, when an animal is declared by God to be unclean, it doesn't mean he doesn't like that animal, or if he had pets, he would never have that one. It doesn't mean that. It means, for the distinctions that he's drawing, consider that one unclean.
Right,
that one doesn't fit the picture, right? He created eels, so there's really nothing wrong with an eel, but that one doesn't fit the picture, the perfect creation order picture.
Right, they serve a purpose, but it's
that's right.
The purpose is not to be eaten by us.
That's right, and let's jump ahead. We'll come back to this, but just as a little heads up, see, all this issue finds its ultimate resolution in the New Testament, where Jesus declares all food clean. And Peter is shown a vision of unclean animals, clean
right.
and unclean, in the book of Acts. And God shows it to him and says, arise, kill, and eat. Like, you can eat any of this now. And Peter's
right.
like, whoa.
You know, we haven't been able to do
God's
that.
Face, he's saying no three times. So that's how embedded these laws had become. But the purpose of that, when Peter finally gets what that vision was all about, he goes and preaches to Cornelius, the Gentile, saying, God's shown me. There's no distinction among the people of God now. The Jews and Gentiles are on equal footing.
Right.
So in the New Testament, these things all find their resolution. And this was about Jew-Gentile distinction
right.
in a lot of ways, in almost every way. So that's the big picture that's going on. Okay, so I think you're starting to see the picture, but let me read a little more, because I think there's still some more training we need to do in our minds before we read this material.
It's almost like stretching your mind so that you can go...
taking it. That's right. Yeah, we're doing our warm-up exercise. So the system of permitted and forbidden animals was a microcosm of the world, according to the Israelite view. The forbidden, unclean animals represented the surrounding nations, or the humankind in the earth. Clean animals represented the Israelites in the land. And sacrificial animals among clean animals represented the priests in the sanctuary of the Lord. See all those divisions going on?
So that's what Alan Ross is saying that we're getting
big
there because
picture.
We,
that's the takeaway. In other words, if you ask, let's just pick a name, Joe Israelite, okay, 1450 BC, well, a little bit later now, few years later, they've come away from Sinai. Actually, they're technically still at Mount Sinai, but they've come out of Egypt, and they're in the wilderness, okay? And if you and I had a time machine, and Moses had just written this and read it to the people, and you and I, you know, stood there off in the side, and we listened to this, and then after the presenting of this material, we, psst, Joe, come here. Joe walks over and we go, what do you think he was talking about? This is what he would tell you. We're being distinguished from the Gentiles around us. And then even within our own, even within the own ranks of Israel, this, the priesthood class is being distinguished. That's what he would say.
Well, as we get into what I think the next four or five chapters, it, you know, almost painstakingly, he goes through,
details it out.
This is how we're, you know, it,
because it's the role of the priest, right? Mm-hmm. They're the guys, the Levites are the guys who are going to be making these distinctions in Israel. You can eat that, you can't eat that. This is clean, this is not clean.
Mm-hmm.
So that's right. That's what we're going to get examples of all of this in the next few chapters, in almost like their textbook. Hey, here's how to distinguish the clean and the unclean. Let's jump ahead again too. Not even the Jew-Gentile distinction kind of thing, but in our own lives. how do you distinguish clean from unclean? And we'll flesh this out a little more, because even though I don't know what other word you could possibly put down there as a translation other than clean and unclean, it still does not. When you hear unclean, you think, you know, evil.
Right.
And it's not saying an unclean thing is not necessarily evil. It could be, but not necessarily. Might be a fine, perfectly normal thing. It's just not clean for the purposes that God's trying to explain here. So in our own lives, you know, as you make choices, where to live, what to do for work, who to get involved with, as friends and in business relationships, all those kind of things involve this kind of discernment.
Right.
So there's important lessons for us here. The system of order in the world, based on the order of creation, called for making distinctions within the animal world. The animals had to conform to their groups as God had made them. So Israel had to conform to the physical and spiritual standards of its group as God had required of them. Moral perfection as the covenant people. Just as the Israelites had to avoid unclean animals, so they had to separate from the pagan world around them. Thus, the meaning was both practical and symbolic. Israel had to remain a separate nation, and the dietary laws made it difficult to socialize with pagans who ate these things. So
is the audience here, Bob, do they see these laws as they're being given to them? As that, do they see it that they're being distinguished amongst the world, or do they see it as rules?
No, I think they do. We do a disservice to the ancient Israelite when we say he would have just seen it as rules. I don't think so, and I can actually point to a specific passage, a few hundred years down the road from here, but that shows that clearly. In the Psalms, David, who knows the law, he knows the book of Moses inside and out, says to God in one of the Psalms, "Whole burnt offerings and sacrifices you have not required, but it's a humble, obedient heart, you know, that you're looking for." And you read that and you go, really? We had a bunch of pages here saying
that was required,
this is what we're supposed to do. There you go. In the Bible itself, this is not exactly, they were looking at it in a much deeper way. Not that you shouldn't not practice it. They were supposed to practice it. So it did function as literally rules to live by, but it was much more than that, and they knew that.
Gotcha.
There was a huge teaching function to it, not just a list of rules. And,
gotcha.
And they knew that. You have statements to that effect. I mean, how could Jesus come along and literally say, declare all foods clean? Right? In the full scope of things, he's the guy actually writing these laws, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're reading the Bible, you're reading God's words. Jesus is God. So here, God comes along going, you can eat whatever you want now. Huh.
Well,
sounds like there was a deeper lesson going on here. And that's exactly right.
And that's exactly what it is, right?
Because
even in hearing you just say that, it like clicked again what you just pointed out, that now it's not, they're not distinct from the rest of the world. The rest of the world can be grafted into their family.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Not the other way around. I mean,
that's right.
But it can come towards them, not away from them. Correct?
That's right.
Okay.
Now let me read one last section, because this is kind of interesting. This takes it to another level. I only read it. We don't usually do this on the podcast. That is, go down, you know, a little bit of rabbit trails. But this one's kind of interesting. It's good food for thought. I'm not saying this is necessarily what the text is pointing out, but it's interesting to think about. So, one guy makes the following classifications. His name is Cass, K-A-S-S. Good scholar. Number one. Concerning like what foods are unclean or prohibited. Creatures that have no proper or unambiguous place, like amphibians, would be unclean. Number two, creatures that have no proper form, like an incompletely cloven-footed animal, right? Something different about how that thing walks, so unclean. Number three, creatures that violate proper locomotion. That's more the walk idea. Number four, creatures that violate the original dietary code, showing no respect for life, like carnivores. You know, a lion would be unclean. There's nothing wrong with a lion, right? It's the symbol of Jesus, the lion of the tribe of Judah, but he's a carnivore. And you're not supposed to be indiscriminately devouring life, right? So those kinds of lessons. So in other words, any creature that violated a principle of creation, any of those creatures are not permitted for food. Israel had to live in harmony with the Lord's order of creation. Another great scholar, Jacob Milgram, does a lot of work on Leviticus. Basically follows a symbolic approach that sees the chapter's instructions in harmony with the created order. But he emphasizes that this chapter taught Israel the importance of and respect for life. This he sees as part of the injunction for Israel to move toward the holy and away from the impure, to imitate God. Milgram explains that since the earlier priestly material held the view that meat was strictly God's fare, then for Israel to partake of meat required that they do so at God's table, so to speak, according to God's distinctions. To take a life, or even to touch a carcass, was a serious matter. And so in view of Leviticus 11, Israel's choice of animal food was severely limited. Milgram thus suggests that this is the missing piece to contemplate the rationale for the dietary system. God was teaching the Israelites reverence for life, life he created, by reducing their choices to a few animals, by limiting the way these animals could be killed, and by prohibiting the blood. Now, I'm not fully sold on all that, but it's interesting to think about. The dietary laws then were designed to make Israel distinct, this is the main point, from the other nations, associating unclean animals with the nations and clean animals with Israel. They legislated that the diet should follow the order of creation, in which God made a number of distinctions. Thus, by their diet, the people were imitating the holiness of God and living according to the design of the Creator of all life.
Well, and I see that, you know, now that you're pointing it out and that you're reading Alan Ross, and it's kind of opening my mind to that. There's respect for life is what's really being...
That's a lot of it. It's tied up with some other ideas. Let me read this again, okay?
Yep,
let me read this
again.
Last paragraph again. The dietary laws were designed to make Israel distinct from the other nations, associating unclean animals with the nations and clean animals with Israel. They legislated that the diet should follow the order of creation, in which God made a number of distinctions. Thus, by their diet, the people were imitating the holiness of God and living according to the design of the Creator of all of life.
Well, and we'll read that at the end of chapter 11 about man and Israel being holy.
That's right.
You know, not like God, but in... I don't even know how to put that.
Well, I mean, are we back to saying seeing the world the way God sees it?
Does that
summarize it?
That does.
Yeah,
that absolutely does.
Okay, so we're probably, having laid that foundation, we're probably ready to read it now.
Yeah.
Why don't we do that?
Ish.
All right.
I don't want to.
Well, I know because you know, understanding the word is a never-ending process. So. Yeah, we'll always be reviewing the material. So here we go, Leviticus chapter 11. The Lord spoke again to Moses and to Aaron, saying to them, "Speak to the sons of Israel, saying, these are the creatures which you may eat from all the animals that are on the earth. Whatever divides hoof, thus making split hooves, and chews the cud, among the animals that you may eat. Nevertheless, you are not to eat of these. Among those which chew the cud, or among those which divide the hoof, the camel, for though it chews the cud, does not divide the hoof. It's unclean to you. Likewise, a rock badger, for though it chews cud, it does not divide the hoof. It's unclean to you. The rabbit also, for though it chews cud, it does not divide the hoof. It's unclean to you. And the pig, for though it divides the hoof, thus making a split hoof, does not chew the cud. It is unclean to you. You shall not eat of their flesh, nor touch their carcasses. They are unclean to you. These you may eat, whatever's in the water, all that have fins and scales, those in the water, in the seas, or in the rivers, you may eat. But whatever's in the seas and in the rivers that does not have fins and scales, among the teeming life of the water, and among all the living creatures that are in the water, they are detestable things to you. They shall be abhorrent to you. You may not eat of their flesh, and their carcasses you shall detest. Whatever's in the water does not have fins and scales is abhorrent to you. These, moreover, you shall detest among the birds. They are abhorrent, not to be eaten. The eagle, and the vulture, and the buzzard, and the kite, and the falcon, and its kind, every raven in its kind, and the ostrich, and the owl, and the seagull, and the hawk in its kind, and the little owl, and the cormorant, and the great owl, and the white owl, and the pelican, and the carrion vulture, and the stork, and the heron in its kind, and the hoopoe, and the bat. All the winged insects that walk on all fours are detestable to you. Yet these you may eat among all the winged insects which walk on all fours, those which have above their feet jointed legs and with which to jump on the earth. These of them you may eat, the locust and its kind, and the devastating locust and its kinds, and the cricket and its kinds, and the grasshopper and its kinds. But all other winged insects which are four-footed are detestable to you. By these, moreover, you will be made unclean. Whoever touches their carcasses becomes unclean until evening. Whoever picks up any of their carcasses shall wash his clothes and be unclean until evening. Concerning all the animals which divide the hoof but do not make a split hoof, or which do not chew cud, they are unclean to you. Whoever touches them becomes unclean. Also, whatever walks on its paws, among all the creatures that walk on all fours, are unclean to you. Whoever touches their carcasses becomes unclean until evening. The one who picks up their carcass shall wash his clothes and be unclean until evening. They are unclean to you. Now these are to you the unclean among the swarming things which swarm on the earth, the mole, the mouse, the great lizard and its kinds, and the gecko and the crocodile, and the lizard, and the sand reptile, and the chameleon. These are to you the unclean among all the swarming things. Whoever touches them when they are dead becomes unclean until evening. Also, anything on which one of them may fall when they are dead becomes unclean, including any wooden article, or clothing, or a skin, or a sack, any article on which use is made. It shall be put in the water and be unclean until evening. Then it becomes clean. As for any earthenware vessel into which one of them may fall, whatever is in it becomes unclean, and you shall break the vessel. Any of the food which may be eaten on which water comes shall become unclean, and any liquid which may be drunk in every vessel shall become unclean. Everything, moreover, on which part of their carcass may fall becomes unclean. An oven or a stove shall be smashed. They are unclean, shall continue as unclean to you. Nevertheless, a spring or a cistern collecting water shall be clean, though the one who touches their carcass shall be unclean. If a part of their carcass falls on any seed for sowing which is to be sown, it's unclean. Though if water is put on the seed and a part of their carcass falls on it, it's unclean to you. Also, if one of the animals dies which you have for food, the one who touches its carcass becomes unclean until evening. He too who eats some of its carcass shall wash his clothes and be unclean until evening. And the one who picks up its carcass shall wash his clothes and be unclean until evening. Now, every swarming thing that swarms on the earth is detestable, not to be eaten. Whatever crawls on its belly, and whatever walks on all fours, whatever has many feet, in respect to every swarming thing that swarms on the earth, you shall not eat them, for they are detestable. Do not render yourselves detestable through any of the swarming things that swarm. You shall not make yourselves unclean with them, so that you become unclean. For I am the Lord God. Consecrate yourselves, therefore, and be holy, for I am holy. You shall not make yourselves clean with any of the swarming things that swarm on the earth. Yeah, you shall not make yourselves unclean, thank you, with any of the swarming things that swarm on the earth. For I am the Lord who brought you up from the land of Egypt to be your God. Thus you shall be holy, for I am holy. This is the law regarding the animal and the bird, every living thing that moves in the waters, and everything that swarms on the earth, to make a distinction between the unclean and the clean, and between the edible creature and the creature which is not to be eaten.
So, it again, for me, even with that background that we got, Bob, and reading this through again, it's very easy as a reader to get caught up in just all these,
in the minutiae of,
right,
and all the little details.
It almost forces you to look there.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd have to continue to remind myself that we're talking bigger picture here, mm-hmm, and trying to, you know, keep that bigger picture in mind.
That's right.
You know, because as we went through, first of all, he's speaking to Moses and Aaron.
Mm-hmm. Good observation.
Yes.
Yeah, well, the priest, see, it's incumbent. Moses was not really considered a priest. He was more of a prophet. If you ask Joe Israelite,
okay,
he's going to go, "Ah, that's our prophet." Okay, but Aaron, that's our high priest.
Right, right. Okay. And is that why he's brought in?
Yes, because these are priestly functions to make these distinctions. So God was speaking to Moses and Aaron. Hey, here's how you learn between the clean and the unclean.
And it really, you know, now that you've shared the setup with me, it really makes sense, you know, and it really goes into it in the bird part.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And some of those words, by the way, for the vast, vast majority of the words we have in the Hebrew Old Testament, we know what they mean. We have a pretty good dictionary for that. But some of these words are like technical. They're not used in a lot of sentences,
mm-hmm,
that we have from ancient Hebrew. Some of them, we're not exactly sure what animal that is.
Which bird?
You know, we'll say like the great owl and the lesser owl. And like, I don't exactly know what that is.
Right.
But they would have known.
But that's not really the point.
No, that's not the point anyway. That's exactly right.
But it's so easy, and I'm sure our listeners fall into the same thing I do, where you read this and you really start asking yourself, why am I reading this? I'm not eating a snake.
Yeah.
You know, even though a locust is okay, I don't think I'm eating that either.
It's those lessons. And even as I read, you know, the chapter, given our preamble, I was reading it a little differently myself. You know, mm-hmm, make sure you stay away from the Gentiles and be distinct to me.
Right.
And things that don't inhabit a clear distinction in the creation order, you know, learn those lessons. And so that's how I was reading it in my own mind.
Well, and as I think we pointed this out or used this analogy on a couple of previous podcasts, but it's really the boundaries that create the power. Like we talked about the riverbank. Yeah. You know, what mm-hmm, what gives a river its power? Is it the water or
it's
the bank?
Banks. That's right.
And
well,
so
it's both, but yeah, that's right.
But it's those boundaries that really mm-hmm distinguish
mm-hmm
it
mm-hmm
from the rest of the land.
Yeah. I love that illustration, because if you take the banks away, you know, even as hard as our river is flowing right now,
mm-hmm,
right? This is July, 11th? Our river is almost never up this high. Certainly not in July. And it's running full force. But if you took away those banks, like you'll see in Edwards,
It just spreads out.
It spreads out and does nothing. The river's totally calm.
Mm-hmm.
You know, infant could wade in there. There's no power to it. A couple miles down the river, you wouldn't go near that thing. It's so powerful because the banks have closed it in now.
Right. And that's kind of the picture, you know, that you've given me to think about before, that I kind of saw here as well. Without these rules and distinctions, or laws and distinctions, it would really lose power. It would lose not effectiveness, but
And so
would it have the same effect?
Yeah, that's right. And so you think of Christians, you know, today coming in, being adopted into Israel's family, so to speak. And rightly so.
Sure.
I mean, God declares it that way. Jews and Gentiles are on equal footing now as the people of God.
But not at this point.
Not at this point. But always if you come by faith. But all that to say, the express people of God now are Jew and Gentile. But have we lost the value of these kinds of distinctions? I'm not advocating in any way that we go back to some kind of food laws. I'm not saying
no.
And the Bible's not saying that. That would be expressly wrong to do that. But have we really learned these lessons? You know, when Jesus says you can eat anything now, that's right, but make sure you're doing that with your eyes wide open.
Well, and you know, as far as distinction, you know, just go to a mall and look around, and probably 70-80% of the people you see in a mall are going to go to a church of some sort, you know, weekly or close to. And if you asked them, they would say, yeah, I consider myself Christian. But that distinction is not so distinct that you can recognize it.
Can the unbeliever tell?
No. Sometimes. Rare occasions.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Rare occasions. You run into those
people. Yeah, there's
people
that walk the faith so well that everybody knows.
Yeah, you know immediately.
That's right. But most of the time, we look no different than our culture.
Yep.
And that's every preacher's nightmare, because everybody realizes that. And we're not really solving that issue.
No, I would agree. And now it picks up steam in verse 44. 44 through 47 is where I look at it.
Yeah, the conclusion to the chapter. You know, he's stepping back from the laws a little bit and giving you, you know, the big... he's wrapping his arms around the whole thing and saying, here's some purpose to all this. Be holy, for I am holy.
And that one, that grabbed me when I read that, because I was like, wait a second. He's describing us as holy.
In a separate sense that these are a people, no.
Right.
No. But in that, they are a people separated from all the peoples on the earth to be God's particular possession. Mm-hmm. He is their king. He's sovereign over the whole universe, but he is particularly their king.
But when, you know, just to kind of dig in a little bit more there, when he describes us holy and him holy, that's two different, is it two different types of holy? Or, it's not the same. I mean, I know that, but I don't know how to categorize
and
that.
And I don't either, so I can't really answer that question. There is a distinction there, but there's not.
Yeah, it's,
but he's saying holy for both.
Yeah,
but yeah, there's a
innately
distinction.
You know that,
yeah, that's right.
that's not, you know.
That's right.
Because his holiness is pure, ours is distinct.
Yeah, and he repeats it in 45.
Yeah. Yep.
So 44, 45, saying the same thing.
Thus you shall be holy, for I. So it's funny, Bob. It, you know, in a sense, both funny, ha-ha, and funny, interesting, that this chapter is pretty well summarized, verses 44 through 46, But there was some major detail that we had to go through to even get to that understanding, and we were laughing about it a little bit, but was it to keep them from, each one of them kind of forming their own opinions mm-hmm. of what's clean and unclean?
Yeah, well, certainly it was to instruct them in those types of things. But let me take this in the last couple minutes here in a whole different direction.
Oh, no. Okay. Oh, no, I just understood.
And I didn't prepare you for this. But since it's our podcast, we're allowed to,
free
underneath
will.
God's authority, obviously. But let's freewheel a little bit. You ready to do that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this is speculation. Okay, so how do we say it in church? You can punt.
You punting is available.
You can punt on this if you want. Back to Genesis 1 and 2, when God created the world, the high point of that creation was mankind, mm-hmm. because we were his image. Is the animal realm in the image of something? If mankind is in the image of God, is it fair to push that thought that, well, maybe the animal realm is also, in an image.
And what are you
so,
thinking?
Okay, well, here, when you and I have read the book of Ezekiel together,
mm-hmm.
what did those angels look like?
Animals.
One had the face, they had four faces, an eagle, a lion,
right?
A bull, and a man. Is the animal realm reflective of the angelic realm? And if so, is that what's ultimately lying behind some of the clean and unclean? Some of this angelic realm has rebelled against God. We know them as the demons. So are some of the animals reflective of that rebellion in heaven? Now, I don't have an answer for you.
So
I'm
we
just
can
saying,
punt.
You can punt. I'm just saying it's kind of interesting that when Ezekiel describes those angels, the cherubim, the highest ranking angels that move the throne of God around in the heavenlies, there's animal features there. Now, let's put some more data out there.
Okay.
Those are holy angels in that case, right? And an eagle would not be, that would be an unclean animal in our chapter here. So,
right.
So maybe these distinctions don't hold. But I'm speculating that perhaps the animal realm reflects the angelic realm. I don't know that. I'm just saying it's kind of interesting. And that's not the point of this chapter. Either
right,
way, it's
right,
not
right.
the point of the chapter.
Just a little mind-expanding thought.
Just a little heads up. There's nowhere to really go with it. That
right.
doesn't affect our behavior, or that doesn't give us a new law to live by or anything like that. Just kind of interesting. Just food for thought.
It's fun to stretch your mind that way in one sense, because
it's a good pun. Food for thought. What you can eat.
And I didn't even mean that way. So, but it really is. It's fun to stretch your mind that way, to at least start thinking outside the box and really, not just looking at this and going, okay, well, we're not in 1450. We don't, none of this. I don't even see the animal that I eat.
Yeah,
it's
I eat bacon all the time,
right,
and I don't even worry about it.
It's packaged at the store. But that's not the message we're getting here.
Be distinct.
And how many times, I can't tell you, Bob, that I've read stuff like this, and I would literally be like, all right, don't have anything to do with that.
Yeah, now you're 10 chapters
yep.
ahead, skipping to something that looks like it relates
maybe,
to you.
Maybe I should just go to the New Testament here.
Yeah.
Because
but that whole principle of distinction, and like I said, it's every preacher's bane, that we don't look any different than our culture in Western Christianity. The Joe Christian on the street looks exactly like Joe non-Christian on the street. Is Joe Christian a good guy? Yep. So is Joe non-Christian a lot of times.
Right.
In a limited sense, right? Is Joe Christian a bad guy? Sometimes. Is Joe non-Christian a bad guy? Sometimes. I mean, what would distinguish us? You know, the fact that we don't we miss the first game on Sunday because we're at church? No, we TiVo it. So when we go home, we get to watch it. I mean, we're doing the same things, you know.
Right, so there is no distinguishing.
Not a lot. You know, and the ultimate badge of distinction, a number of great Christian authors in the last generation have written about this, the ultimate distinction should be love.
Yeah.
That's love and truth are the badges of the Christian, and that should show up in our thoughts and our behavior. That's the ultimate distinction.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, my friend, I'm sure we could go several hours more on this chapter alone. But should we
let's say a prayer. Let's send it out in God's good hands. And we'll have a great time on our next podcast. Lord, thank you for the gift of your words. Impress them in our minds, but bury them in our hearts, that we might be transformed into the image of our great God and Savior, Jesus Christ, in whose name we pray. Amen.
Amen.